Hey everyone, welcome back to the Future Cities Podcast. I'm your host for the week, Jason Sauer, a PhD candidate over at Arizona State University, but currently living in Valdivia, Chile during all of the social unrest. This week's episode focuses on trash, which is more formally known as solid waste, as well as how this trash or solid waste can hamper efforts to make cities more resilient to flooding. I'm going to open the episode with a not-so-brief background on trash and its conception as a problem, talk about the approaches individuals and larger groups are taking to deal with it, all before heading into an interview with researcher Dr. Aaron Rivers over at North Carolina State University, whose work on flood-resilient infrastructure in cities has been impacted by trash and its overabundance. So solid waste, which I will mostly refer to here as trash, is a complex social, ecological, and technological systems issue. An estimated 2 billion people do not even have access to trash collection services. And even in places where trash service is available, trash issues are not really resolved by simply being sent away to landfills or recycling centers. So trash that goes to landfills requires fuel and personnel for transportation. It requires space to reside more permanently. It slowly leaches chemicals into the ground and into waterways that are damaging to humans and the environment. And trash, of course, emits greenhouse gases like methane as it decays. This doesn't even account for the energy and chemical waste that are required in the production of the items that later become trash. Recycling also suffers from its own limitations, both in its reach as well as in the abilities of the process. So a 2017 paper in Science Advances found that since 1950, which is when large-scale plastics manufacturing really began, only about 9% of the plastics produced have been recycled. About 12% of it has ended up in incineration, and 79% of it has entered landfills in the environment. Of items that make it into recycling, materials like aluminum and glass are recycled fairly easily and with little degradation in their quality. But plastics, which are made of long-chain polymers derived from fossil fuel sources, degrade over time as the recycling process shortens these polymers and causes the plastics to lose their sort of cohesive properties. These degraded plastics, as they're called, have limited utility and are most often turned into clothing or construction materials before they are ultimately sent to landfill or left in the environment as litter. There are research and industry initiatives to figure out how to extend the life cycle of plastics, but the rates of what is known as virgin plastic, or new plastic, production are projected to increase well into the future. Our global recycling systems can also face shocks and disruptions, such as what has occurred in the United States since 2018, when China declared that they would no longer be accepting United States plastics due to their low purity, which is basically saying that we don't sort them well enough in order for China to convert them into a reusable product. So, in addition to reducing the amount of trash we produce, it is probably also worth considering a reduction in the amount that we need to send through what is clearly an imperfect recycling system with very limited reach. The sheer volume of items we produce and consume every day, it is no wonder we find trash in so many places. The average American generates about 2.2 kilograms of trash a day just in the course of accomplishing their daily activities. But rates of trash production do not need to be like this, and in fact they haven't been this high for very long. For a sort of idealized scenario, think of the classic milkman from movies and cartoons, who would deliver milk door-to-door in glass bottles and collect the empty ones for washing and refilling and ultimately reusing. A number of food and product industries used to assume some responsibility for the recovery of their products at the end of their use and recycling them much in the same way as the milkman did. In the 1940s, when Coca-Cola was only distributing their products in glass bottles, consumers used to put down a deposit worth almost half the price of the bottle in order to incentivize them to return it. But of course, over time, that changed, with producers shifting the burden of retrieval and disposal onto the consumer public. Barto L. Moore, the author of a book called Citizen Coke, The Making of Coca-Cola Capitalism, details the history of this shift in end-life responsibilities of products, and argues that the rise of recycling and the loss of the deposit system could be described as a, quote, massive subsidy that we ended up giving the beverage industry, end quote. I bring up this alternate framing of who should shoulder the burden of trash management, not just because it is interesting, but because I'm going to be talking with someone in this interview today about trash problems in very specific cities. I want to be very clear from the outset that I do not view trash in Baltimore or any city that we talk about or work in as problems caused by the citizens or the local culture. Like the author Barto L. Moore and others, I view trash mostly as a problem created by industry practices of distribution and retrieval, which have been prolonged and worsened by shortcomings in politics and governance. Stated directly, I do not think trash and litter is rightfully blamed on personal choices. Many parts of the world have access to Coke and Lay's products long before they ever have access to trash removal services, and again, 2 billion people still do not have these services in any capacity. And it's a matter of historical record that advertising campaigns that push narratives about personal responsibility with trash and litter, such as the infamous crying Native American ad from the 1970s, have been literally funded by bottle and can producers whose products we've been made responsible for. Changes in personal behavior, like depositing trash and recycling in designated spaces, can only get us so far given the amount of trash and recycling being produced is a problem in its own right. And campaigns to change personal behavior are only so effective and intentionally divert people's attention away from larger systematic reform of the production, distribution, and retrieval of products. I also have somewhat of a vested interest in this framing because my job is impacted by the ways that people conceptualize trash as a problem. So for example, I spent 10 weeks this summer working in Hermosillo, Mexico, interviewing people over their experiences with flooding in the city. And many of those interviewees identified that the flooding in their neighborhood is not due to inadequate drainage infrastructure, but rather due to infrastructure being clogged with trash. Again, in Hermosillo, I worked with city planners who were beginning projects to install more green spaces and green infrastructure in the city, but who had no plans for routine maintenance and cleanup. So that means that the green infrastructure that they were planning would likely suffer from the same technical underperformance as the existing gray infrastructure did due to trash fouling, plus suffer from visual blight that diminishes the aesthetic value of these green infrastructure projects. Trash or solid waste, and who is responsible for creating it, is also part of my general crusade about what I see in the literature and among planners as a mischaracterization of problems with green infrastructure. Going back to the first episode I hosted on urban community gardens and green gentrification, my point was not that community gardens are inherently bad for causing gentrification, but rather that the socioeconomic forces, including racism, are bad for perverting community gardens into tools of gentrification. People should be able to garden without fear that it will circle back and raise their rents. In a similar vein, I have heard arguments that we should hesitate to plant trees in poorer neighborhoods because people worry that these trees will increase rates of crime. But of course, the problem here is not trees. Wealthy neighborhoods are full of trees that are not generating crime, rather the socioeconomic systems that turn people toward violent criminal behavior. I also see this mischaracterization in discussions of public parks, where neighborhoods hesitate about adding parks or particular kinds of park benches because they are concerned about homeless populations using them. So public parks and benches are good, and homeless people are just people. The problem, insofar as there is one, are the socioeconomic forces that create homelessness. Homelessness is the correctly identified problem. My point more broadly in this is that in avoiding green infrastructure solutions like bioswales and urban gardens and trees and parks, rather than confronting broader socioeconomic problems in cities, modern city planners are perpetuating the very inequalities and injustices that they ostensibly are trying to fix. But all of that is relatively high order stuff, and I want to start you all out on a more grounded level. In today's episode, again, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Erin Rivers about her work in Baltimore on a unit of green infrastructure called a bioswale. And so bioswales represent this small subset of green infrastructure objects that you might see in your city now and into the future that are of some point of contention. And she's going to give a better explanation of what exactly they are. However, I think her work experience and how she got to thinking about trash and how she got to thinking about these higher order problems are probably emblematic about how a lot of us in academics and research got us started thinking about these problems in the first place. So I hope you enjoy. Hey, this is Jason Sauer. I am sitting down with Erin Rivers, a doctor now. I'm sorry, I almost called you a PhD student. A doctor now, congratulations. And a researcher over at North Carolina State University, where she is doing her postdoctoral work currently. How you doing, Erin?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on today.
I'm glad to have you. So I guess if you could just first talk about yourself a bit, where are you from? What's your academic background? What are your general research interests?
Yeah. So as you said, I'm currently a postdoc at NC State University, and here I am in soil science department working on some projects that are evaluating the effectiveness of a variety of soil amendment techniques on reducing highway runoff quantities, improving some of the water quality coming off of the interstate projects. And we're working a lot with the Department of Transportation here in North Carolina. Historically, I've been more rooted in the green stormwater infrastructure realm. During my master's, I was at UNC, University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and we were looking at the impact of point source discharge from stormwater ponds on some in-stream processes. I, in particular, look at denitrification and some nitrogen biogeochemistry. In my dissertation research at Portland State, I worked a little bit with the SRN group, and I was looking at the temporal and spatial variability in soil biogeochemical processes in bioretention facilities. So these are things like bioswales, rain gardens, stormwater planters. They go by a lot of names, but in general, they are these small-scale, nature-based solutions to dealing with impervious runoff from cities. Some of my more interesting finds from these studies were that in terms of nitrogen cycling processes, bioswales across the country.
Actually, can I stop you there real quick? Can you describe just verbally what a bioswale is? It's something that I think all of us in the network have now dealt with extensively, but it's probably something that most people have seen, but just never really registered as like a distinct engineering unit or anything like that. So can you describe both?
So when I talk about bioswales or bioretention facilities, these are engineered structures that are designed to mitigate stormwater runoff from entering surface waters by means of infiltration or discharge mechanisms that end up going to the stormwater sewer system. And so we call them slightly different things from bioretention, bioswales, rain gardens, but the differences between these structural distinctions are nuanced, and the sites generally have a basic design of surface vegetation, a growing medium, which is generally a prepared soil mixture, a gravel underlayer, and then an underdrain or overflow discharge mechanism if underlying soils don't meet infiltration standards.
Okay. So,
is that too technical, or do we want to talk like broader?
No, that works. I'm trying to think of if I didn't have any engineering sort of backgrounds or really any introduction. So, I mean, where would you find a bioswale, for example, or something like that in a city or in the cities that you've worked in at least?
Yeah, so it's really funny though, because I think like in this world, in the green infrastructure world, we talk about these very vaguely as bioswales, but in the engineering world, or if you come over here to the soil world, a bioswale is a very distinct thing, which is actually not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so when they think bioswales, they think of like a grass swale, like unbounded. It's just like a ditch. And that's usually not what we're talking about. But there's so many different ways of naming these facilities. So the facilities that I'm talking about are generally small scale on the side of a road. They often occur as curb cutouts or between the sidewalk and the road. And so they're usually somewhere between like 200 to 1,000 square feet, just depending on the size of the project. Other names are like street trees green streets. And stormwater planters, curb extensions. So they're essentially just a depression between the sidewalk and the street that has a vegetated growing medium. And so they're designed to hold a distinct amount of runoff and infiltrate that to retain some of the stormwater from going into the sewer system.
Right. And so you did a lot of work in biogeochemistry on this. And I think you talked about this with your general description as well. So one of the main functions of these bioswales, they do hold that water, but they also are designed for treatment of runoff, right?
Like, to some degree, I think that a lot of cities, so every city is a little bit different in how they're approaching their stormwater plans. I know in terms of Portland, it's a city that has a combined sewer overflow system, which means that the sanitary sewers and the stormwater sewers are connected. And when there's a big rain event, these sewers combine and they overflow, meaning that some of the solid waste and sanitary waste are getting discharged into surface water bodies. The cities that have CSOs are really concerned about reducing the sheer quantity of stormwater runoff coming off of the landscape, just to relieve some of the pressure on the CSO so that we're discharging less of that into the streams. But then some other cities may just want to relieve some pressure on their stormwater system, even if they have separated sewers. So I think that in general, the primary objective of employing the use of bioswales or bioretention in cities is to reduce the quantity of stormwater runoff that is either being discharged into streams or going into the sewer systems. But yes, secondary benefits include stormwater treatment. And so we get some benefits of filtration from the soils. We get biogeochemical transformations where we're transforming pollutants. In my work, I specifically look at nitrogen transformations, and I'm very interested in the potential of these systems to remove nitrogen via denitrification, which is a microbially mediated process where microbes can use nitrate as an energy source, and they transform that compound into atmospheric nitrogen. So it's a permanent removal pathway for nitrogen in the environment. And so that's something that a lot of managers are really interested in, getting that water quality benefit, since nitrogen tends to be a really common water pollutant in a lot of urban areas. And that also leads to, or speaks to the biggest benefit of using green infrastructure as a stormwater control, because we get the secondary treatment benefits.
Right. And nitrogen reduction in stormwater is like critical, especially, I shouldn't say especially, but a lot of coastal cities in particular are really focused on it, because that nitrogen, if it makes it out to the ocean, can of course cause algal blooms and hypoxia and disrupt oceanic or coastal communities, especially fishermen. So I worked up over at University of Connecticut looking at how the Connecticut River was loading nitrogen into the Long Island Sound and driving these massive fish kills and hypoxia events and things like that. So cities really think it's important, or rather states more broadly think this sort of nitrogen conversion is critical for managing for coastal health and things like that. And that's been your experience in Baltimore and in Portland as well?
Yes, in Baltimore, of course, the Chesapeake is dealing with a lot of nitrogen loading issues, and they have a very common sort of challenge where they have agricultural areas in the upper extents of the watershed, and then they have their cities are concentrated at the bottom of the watershed, and so they already have nitrogen loaded waters coming into the city, and then further exacerbating the problem within the city before it reaches the bay. Portland was a little bit of a different scenario. I don't want to say that because I'm afraid it's not right anymore. They don't have as big of a concern for nitrogen in Portland. So they're more concerned about the quantity of water, like I kind of talked about a little bit earlier, but they're more concerned about phosphorus. A lot of the watersheds out there are just naturally really high in phosphorus. And so the phosphorus loading tends to be a more critical issue than nitrogen is. And so I'm coming from the Midwest, and then I've done a lot of my research on the East Coast. So in my mind, nitrogen has always been a concern, and I thought that it was just a ubiquitous challenge everywhere. So it was a bit surprising to get to Portland and hear some of the city managers saying that they're not as concerned about nitrogen as a part of this larger stormwater conversation.
Yeah, that's interesting. And of course, that also gets into the classic debates in biogeochemistry literature over phosphorus limitation or nitrogen limitation and things like that. So yeah, that's really cool. So I guess more to the topic of this episode. How did working with these green infrastructure features or bioswales in particular get you to start thinking more about trash or solid waste? Can you talk about those experiences?
A lot of the work in my dissertation was comparative. And so I was really interested in coming in and looking at how this technology that's designed separately and being applied in a geographic context, I was really interested to see how these were being implemented and what the outcomes were when we were putting bioswales across different cities and different climates. And so I went in to look at nitrogen cycling to see how drier climates like Phoenix would compare to wetter climates like Portland. And one of the chapters was a comparative study between Portland and Baltimore. And this speaks to the nuances of designing ecological studies, where we had everything on paper designed to make this similar comparison between Portland and Baltimore. And we get to Baltimore and we see that things are just very different there. And we observed that they had a lot of different environmental challenges, perhaps than Portland did. And so we saw sort of this interesting result on the ground of the bioswales in Baltimore, where they had some issues dealing with some of the trash coming off of the urban landscape. And so this started to become a really interesting question to think about in terms of green infrastructure at large, but also bioswales specifically, as they're intended to be this mechanism to remove and mitigate stormwater runoff from the landscape. But then these concepts or some of these ideas of maintenance may be impacting their capacity to function in terms of capturing that runoff. So, you know, if we have a bioswale soil surface that is inundated with leaves and trash, they may not be functioning hydrologically. So we might not be getting as much infiltration just because the soil surface is clogged with some impermeable surfaces like plastics and leaves.
Right. So you have these structures that you've installed in the city that are designed to ferry water away from these critical systems, allow it to go to kind of infiltration and not enter the stormwater system, which apparently has effects on the overflow from like the general stormwater system as well as the sewage system. But you started finding large amounts of trash and debris in these bioswales, which was reducing their ability to do the stated function. So do you think it was actually having substantial impacts, or would you guess, I don't know if your research actually went into this, but would you guess that this is potentially having substantial impacts on flooding in the city?
So my research did not address that. I think that that's really a great question to move forward with and to start thinking about. And maintenance is becoming a hot topic of conversation in terms of green infrastructure and bioswales. So I think that that's going to be on the forefront of research moving forward. In terms of the soil ecology and soil properties and nitrogen cycling, we actually didn't see a big difference between facilities with higher trash content than facilities with lower trash content, which was pretty surprising, but also pretty interesting, and brings up this question of these different ecosystem services or potential trade-offs. And so we might still be getting similar functions in terms of nitrogen cycling or nitrogen removal. But if we're inhibiting the ability of these facilities to infiltrate stormwater, then, you know, we're impairing a function that these are constructed to do. But in terms of the overall hydrologic capacity of the watershed, whether or not this trash infill is affecting the way the bioswales can function, I'm not sure. My research can't speak to that, but I do think that that's going to be an important question moving forward and can potentially inform some of these maintenance programs that are starting to deal with some of these local challenges.
Yeah, so I wanted to relate my own kind of story on this. So I did research in Mexico this past summer, in Hermosillo, Mexico in particular, where I was interviewing people about their flood exposure and their general experiences with flooding. And I started thinking about trash mostly because people kept on telling me that they thought the drainage system in their area was fine. They didn't really see any sort of lack in design or anything like that, but they did feel that trash was clogging these drainage systems and was ultimately the source of their flooding. And they could show me, like in their own backyards or in local areas, these sort of drainage system structures. Some of it was green, some of it was like more just classic canals and pipes and things like that. That, yeah, I mean, we're totally stuffed with debris, which, you know, I certainly would believe, or I'd that it either causes flooding or it certainly causes a sort of deeper investigation into the general impacts of trash on this drainage system. But I think your experience and mine is probably more of the norm in this kind of field, where we have ideas and personal experiences and stories about how trash is potentially impacting these larger systems, but there probably isn't this kind of larger study on the impacts. So I'm really curious. I'm always you know, happy to, or not happy necessarily, but excited when I hear other people's stories on trash. And so my own thinking on trash in cities is kind of complicated. We talked a bit earlier about like the point about talking about trash for us is not to blame a particular culture in a city or, you know, make some sort of broad statements about the kind of people or anything like that. Trash is everywhere. Like it exists even around recycling centers and thing, you know, areas that should be really hyper-conscious of trash and waste and things like that. I'm much more interested in the sort of ways that we are not thinking about trash, both in terms of the design and implementation of these sorts of resilience or like flood vulnerability projects, and how we're not thinking about trash in that context. And then also other ways that we could be tackling trash issues beyond just, you know, retooling our designs to kind of allow for some trash or things like that. So I guess you have more experiences in Baltimore about the broader culture and actions surrounding trash. So can you talk a bit more about trash in Baltimore? Like who's outspoken about it being a problem or is pushing for solutions in the area? And like, what are some noteworthy events or trash reduction efforts?
Yeah, so Baltimore in particular seems to have a variety of methods in dealing with solid waste. When I was there, I immediately noticed that they have really frequent street sweeping, which in the places that I've lived previously, street sweeping might occur once a quarter or once a year. And so it was really striking to me how much they were investing into street sweeping as a maintenance program. And I know that they've been putting a lot of resources toward their curbside pickup program. Recently, they've distributed, I can't think of the number off the top of my head, but they distributed thousands of new curbside pickup containers. And you might be familiar with Mr. Trash Wheel, which is this really interesting and novel approach that they've developed in the 2000s. And I think that they came out with a new model in 2014. And so this is an animated trash wheel that moves through the bay and collects some of the trash that is floating in the surface waters. And then this trash is then transported to an incinerator.
Yeah, yeah. So just describing Mr. Trash Wheel, so it is supposed to actually look like, you know, a person or some kind of monster, basically, that floats on the surface of the bay and, like, is gobbling up this trash. It has, like, eyes. I don't think it has hands. I'm trying to think.
I don't think so. I'm looking at a picture of it now, and, yeah, it's just kind of like this little insect-looking hungry animal. They've done a really interesting job of promoting this, and Mr. Trashville has his own PR team. It's really funny.
Yeah, and it's spread, right? Like, so this, I guess, more broadly describing what this does, it's designed to pick up surface trash, so the stuff that floats on top of the surface, kind of similar to the efforts that I've seen for cleaning up the you know, quote unquote trash islands. These sort of surface pickers. It's kind of just this conveyor belt that trash that's floating will stick to, or there's enough friction where it will, you know, be forced up the ramp. Basically, maybe there's scoops. I can't remember what Mr. Trashville's tongue looks like in this case.
Yeah, I believe it's just the conveyor belt, and he's solar powered. So this conveyor belt is driven by its own generated power.
So, but I mean, Mr. Trashville has also spread to other cities now as well, right? There's other efforts. I think there's, I forget if there's like a Mrs. Trashwheel also in Baltimore, if that's somewhere else.
That's funny. I didn't know about that, if there is.
Oh, man. Right. So there's the curbside bin. There's Mr. Trashwheel. I guess, what is your sense of like broader discussions within the community of Baltimore about, I don't know, conceiving of trash as a problem
and thinking about solutions, like on the even like so either on like the social level or the sort of industry level, like people mm-hmm. who are responsible for producing the items that ultimately become trash and things like that. Do you have any insights into?
Yeah. So recently, I think over the summer, the Baltimore Sun has put out some articles on this very subject and digging into the challenge that the city has of dealing with the issues of trash. And I know that there's, in particular, Baltimore has quite a few environmental nonprofits that are addressing some of their environmental challenges. And Trash Free Maryland is a nonprofit that seems to have the most directed effort towards addressing some of these issues. But at large, I think that the conversation of trash is so multifaceted and it's so politically rooted in, you know, not just cultural norms, but, you know, extending into ideas of environmental justice and investment or divestment in neighborhoods. And there's a growing literature about littering as a form of protest. And then, you know, it societal norms can drive littering as well. And so if you see somebody throw some trash on the ground, then you're probably going to be more likely to do the same. So if there's already trash there, you know, not feeling necessarily dissuaded from doing the same. And I had some really interesting conversations with, and this is one of the most fun parts, I think, of urban ecology is getting to be in the city and doing ecological research, but getting to interact with some of the folks in the community and people that have an everyday interaction with these facilities.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I had some really interesting conversations when I was sampling bioswales across all of my cities. And so one of the funnier and also eye-opening conversations was with this gentleman who was just asking about my research and what we were looking at. And he didn't know what the facilities were for. So he wasn't sure what the bioswale was for. And so we explained that it was to collect runoff coming off of the street and that it kind of filtered stormwater. And his first response was like, oh, that's really cool. So it's intercepting the trash before it makes it to the bay. And so we were like, yeah, I guess so.
right.
And it was a really interesting perspective to have of, you know, like we kind of look at these more microscopically and we're like, yeah, we want pollutants to be filtered out. But in a way, it is intercepting the trash, I suppose. And so when you think about what that means in terms of just like the overall appearance and what these bioswales are for the community, they're seeing them as more trash receptacles. And so they're probably more likely to be disposing of trash as well. But I think that, you know, in addition to some of these societal norms, some of these more socially oriented questions, I think that we are also talking about one of your earlier points about the distributor's responsibility here. And so disposable culture comes to mind. And especially in cities where there are convenience stores and bodegas located where folks are going to get single-use items and then they're putting them in a plastic bag, I think that that is really proliferating, this issue of having trash on hand and nowhere to put it.
Yeah. I guess two things based on what you've said here. Number one is the idea of this person who you were talking to and who, you know, was relating his experience. Actually thought it was a positive that these things were retaining all of the trash, which is, you know, not something that these bioswales were conceived of. You know, this is not one of the services that they're supposed to provide, but that is one that they are effectively providing. And additionally, the person thought it was good that they were doing that, you know, and, mm-hmm. and in some ways it definitely is. Like, that's trash that's not making its way into your sewer system and threatening to clog it that way, or it's not making it out to the waterways as well. I think it's kind of interesting because there's a tough balance between, like, well, if these bioswales are retaining all this trash, then potentially they become an eyesore and then aren't providing the sort of, like, aesthetic benefits that we had hoped that they would. But if you think about, like, well, okay, if we had this bioswale and it's collecting trash and you had maintenance on top of it, where you had people regularly going and fishing this stuff out, then, you know, the bioswale is still it's still doing its function. It's catching trash every once in a while, and that's an additional one. And with the maintenance, it's potentially not causing any problems. So one thing that I think the bioswale and the trash example highlights nicely, and this is something that comes up in many other areas of the sort of urban resilience research that I do, or the urban ecology research that I do. When we talk about selecting and designing these sort of resilience solutions for the site that we're actually putting this in. So, I mean, I think the broader criticism is that you have these like design firms or these general ideas that are really top level. And then if a city is trying to resolve a problem, they go to these design firms and they just kind of like pick these designs that, you know, have these different characteristics and say, I want that here. And I want it to, you know, reduce flow to this amount or whatever. And then they install it and it doesn't work as intended, or has these other potential negative consequences because they failed to consider the sorts of the social atmosphere, the sort of social considerations. And trash is sometimes considered a social issue. It could also be considered larger societal issues. I don't know how to distinguish that. But you get the general idea. And so one thing that has come up in these sorts of discussions is like, well, if trash is a problem in Baltimore or trash is a problem in these other places, then we shouldn't pursue these sorts of solutions. But the problem isn't necessarily, like, bioswales are still good and still might be desirable in the absence of dealing with this trash. And so I think there's kind of a reluctance on resilience scholars to tackle these like broader societal issues, because it's a much more nebulous thing than just picking a different, you know, bit of infrastructure to install in a particular area. This also comes up when we're talking about planting trees in certain neighborhoods, because there's a perception among some people that it can increase crime. And so then the solution that's kind of thought of among city managers is just, okay, well, then this neighborhood's not going to have trees. But like, the ideal solution is trees and no crime in most places. Like, you know, in the absence of the threat of crime or this sort of like negative side effect of installing the sort of green infrastructure, it would be very desirable. And I think there's kind of a resistance to kind of like tackling these broader social issues. Anyway, I was wondering if you had any experience with that, or like if that's kind of been your shared experience as someone who's much more involved in the technical side, because I'm just kind of a general problem researcher. I don't really do the selection process, but yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting concept in an aspect to the green infrastructure conversation at large. And it's incredibly complex and incredibly contextual. And I think that one of the biggest difficulties to answering some of these questions is how multifaceted these facilities are. And I think that this is also one of the most fascinating parts of the green infrastructure world at large, is that there's so many people working and researching the concept of green infrastructure and green stormwater infrastructure. And from a technical side, you know, I'm a biophysical scientist, and I have proclivities toward the social questions, but I'm not a social scientist. I'm not trained to answer these questions. And so it's really difficult to have, you know, that very diverse and holistic perspective, because we're generally trained on one side or the other. And I think that these conversations are hugely important, and where some of these ideas can kind of spawn into some research. But I know that the environmental justice world is really, really targeting green infrastructure right now. And in particular, bioswales and stormwater infrastructure is slightly different than some other green infrastructure type initiatives. And so if you compare street trees or parks to a bioswale, they're different in that we're installing a bioswale with a utility purpose. And so it's a stormwater asset. We're wanting it to filter and retain runoff. It's not necessarily a place for recreation. And I think that if done well and maintained well, we can benefit from the aesthetics, potentially having education opportunities, you know, in densely populated urban areas. This might be the natural experience that one person has for the day. So I think that those aesthetic benefits can't be underemphasized. But at the same time, we're installing it with a purpose that is really a watershed benefit. So we're putting these in a single point where the people that are benefiting from these structures are distributed through the watershed, if that makes sense. Yeah. Whereas a park, you know, we are still getting some stormwater infiltration. We're getting some of those ecological processes that are distributed, but people that are located next to the park are probably going to be the ones that are deriving more of the benefit from a park or from the trees. So I think that some of these questions are even a little bit split when you consider the different types of green infrastructure structures that we have. But to target some of these particular nuisances like trash, or in other cities, some of the environmental problems were pet waste. You know, folks were just letting their pets go to the bathroom. That was a common problem in Portland. And I'm sure that some of these other cities have even different environmental challenges. And so I think that the important thing in having these be a consistent benefit, having them be well maintained through their lifetime, is not having a set it and forget it attitude about these, which, you know, ecological engineering, and the point of an ecologically engineered facility is to have it be self-sustaining. But I don't think that we can do that in a lot of these densely populated areas where people are constantly interacting with these facilities.
So just a quick thing. Can you talk about the idea of what is set it and forget it? Just for listeners who aren't so familiar.
Set it and forget it is sort of this idea about designing a facility, and we're going to install it to our specifications, and then it should be good to go. It should be self-maintaining. It should be able to function through time with minimal maintenance and interference from us.
Yeah. And so this, gray infrastructure, like pipes and things like that, are kind of a classic example of this. There's very minimal maintenance. It's a hard chunk of concrete that you install in the ground. People don't interact with it. You know, there's problems with like raccoons and other animals that actually really like these spaces and are interacting with it. But they, they're relatively out of the way. You don't really have to think about them much until there's a substantial problem, which shouldn't happen until, you know, they've reached such age, blah, blah, blah. These sorts of like highly engineered structures. But of course, green infrastructure is a bit more flexible. They're, you know, they're more alive systems in a lot of ways. If you're designing them well, it's going to be for more than just the sort of flood mitigation services of them, but for, you know, there's supposed to be plants in there. And again, it's like human experience. That might be the green space that someone sees in their entire day and things like that. I forgot where I was going with this. Green infrastructure is really interesting in that, like, it provides all these benefits. Like, you want to see green spaces in the city. I have lived in cities where there's literally like no green space within I don't know how many kilometers of me. So you really want to install these green areas because there's not a whole lot of opportunities, and you can't import. You can never like buy that experience in a store or something like that. So if you don't plan to have these green spaces in cities, you're just not going to have them. People have to flee the city or, you know, go on vacation from the city to have this sort of experience at all. But it's relatively critical. And I think the idea of green infrastructure does a good job in many ways of giving people these green experiences and providing these other benefits. But yeah, they do require some amount of maintenance.
So I think, you know, considering how different challenges, how different cities experience different challenges in terms of how the maintenance needs of the green infrastructure, some cities may have some challenges dealing with issues of debris and trash buildup, and then other cities may have more issues dealing with people interfering, getting in these facilities, pet waste. I think that really speaks to the nuances in terms of developing maintenance plans. And I think that this is becoming a bigger conversation that cities are having in developing their maintenance plans. And it seems like many cities are really starting to put a lot of effort towards this. And I really like something that really stuck out to me during my research was New York seemed to have a very different approach to designing their facilities. It was subtle, but they have these very small fences surrounding their bioswales, which I didn't see in other places. And I think that this could potentially be something that, you know, it's a subtle difference. It's a subtle addition where if there is issues of clogging infrastructure due to debris from leaves or trash, that a small addition of something like that to kind of exclude some debris from entering the facility could potentially be, you know, an easy and accessible solution. But I think overall, the subtle nuances of challenges that each city has to deal with, I don't know where I was going with that. I don't know if you have any thoughts on continuing that conversation. But I think I'm just trying to get at the point of like how it's not a one size fits all maintenance approach.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think the broader discussion I was thinking of having here is the idea of there is, I think we have to figure out when it's just a matter of like design problems and thinking about, you know, well, we could add this fence to this bioswale to potentially get it to perform more according to how we want it. And those are sort of less less demanding, less intensive ways of like making these structures work in communities. But I think I also wanted to say like my general like thinking now is like you can do that. That's one pathway. But then, of course, the other pathway with trash is to figure out, well, how do we stop the generation of trash in the first place or like all this debris in the first place? And that's a much more complicated social problem that, of course, like I'm not trained to really deal with. You're not trained. There are so many people who aren't necessarily trained to do it. And even the idea of being trained to deal with something like trash doesn't really mean it's going to have any sort of potential impact because that's a larger political issue where you're contacting like states and counties and, you know, maybe even a national campaign to sort of change production culture and recycling culture and doing all of these things. I'm just always like fascinated and frustrated at the same time when we run into these problems with the solutions that we're recommending. And then rather than kind of thinking more holistically about the problem, we kind of default to the easier way of dealing with it, which is like a design tweak or something like that. It's like, well, trash has all these other problems and it would be a huge benefit for so many other things if we could, you know, do something like improve the retrieval process and, you know, get rid of this like single use culture that I say culture, that sounds like I'm blaming people, but the single use practices in a lot of places. But anyway.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a huge conversation and so much bigger than ideas of maintaining green infrastructure and, yeah, and putting the burden on the managers and on the community when in reality, we should probably be critiquing the source of the waste. And I have a lot of friends in Portland that are looking at microplastics in the estuaries and bays out there. And it's just shocking. And so a couple of friends are looking at the prevalence of microplastics in oysters and some of our consumable seafoods and billions of microplastics there. And I think that there's just so many environmental aspects that are affected by this that there really needs to be a shift in the focus of who's thinking about managing these. And maybe it shouldn't be the environmental managers. Maybe it should just be the producers. And
yeah,
I think that's an interesting conversation.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Aaron. Really appreciate you coming on and talking about these issues. Is there any final thoughts you have, either about your own research or trash, bioswales, anything?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on here. I think that continuing this conversation about some of the environmental complexities on trash in the city is really important to research moving forward. And as we start to think of how to best maintain some of these green assets, I think we're really going to have to start considering the context and how we might be addressing these different environmental challenges in each city.
Cool. Thank you so much. And that is the episode for the week. See you in a month. Bye.
The Future Cities podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by the Urban Resilience to Extremes Sustainability Research Network, or UREX as we usually refer to it. To learn more about UREX, visit www.sustainability.asu.edu/urban-resilience. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at futurecitiespodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at futurecitiespod. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.